Welcome to the Microsoft Technology Center in Chicago, everybody. My name is Paul Edlund. And we thought it would be fun today to give you an overview of what Microsoft thinks that cybersecurity, the complete cybersecurity landscape. You know, every company has a little bit of dysfunction. And in Microsoft, we have our own dysfunction too. And one of the things that's a little strange for us is that if you typically ask us for our cybersecurity discussion on any topic, we say, which one? Because there's one for Office 365 and one for Azure, one for pick your product, Windows, Windows Server, SQL, Exchange, et cetera, one for Microsoft Consulting Services, and one for this digital, things called the Digital Crimes Unit. And so what I've done is I've mashed them all together for you guys, and I'm gonna provide like a high level overview of all of these things and how these investments come together. And at some point you might be thinking some of these things don't relate to me, but they do, they're all relative, and all of the investments actually tie together. They come together really gracefully as well. So I'm gonna tell you about some of the things that we're thinking about today as well as where we're going in the future. And with that, you know, I wanna bring up my deck here real fast. And the first thing that I wanna talk about is the Digital Crimes Unit. Microsoft spun this organization up in 2010, and its charter is really twofold. The first one being that we protect vulnerable populations of people, and there are three classes of those, actually. It's the very young, the very old, and something in between, and I'm not gonna go into depth on this, I'm just gonna give you a quick overview. It's basically the very young with child pornography and trying to remove all of the ability for people to share that stuff, and we use a technology called PhotoDNA. When it comes to elderly fraud, it's that call that you get that says, you know, this is Windows support, and if you pay us $200, we'll help you shut down the malware on your computers when there is none. And we're working to shut those things down. And then finally, human trafficking. The outcome of human trafficking is actually money laundering, and so we're working with banks to try and solve that problem. And so the other, in terms of the way that we're actually shutting down the garbage on the internet, no matter where it resides, the Digital Crimes Unit actually uses a few pieces of technology, and actually I'll put that word technology in air quotes. One of them is tons and tons and tons of data, hundreds of millions of touch points a day. If that one is bright and shiny new, the next one is old as dirt stuff. This is gumshoe investigations, walking into places and saying things like, where were you on the night of the 25th? And then lastly, we use legal action, and legal action really is based around this very, very old law that came out of England. It's called the Law of Chattel. And the way that the Law of Chattel works is that if you steal my cow, I can go after you and go after you legally, not only for the value of the cow that you stole, but also all the milk and cheese and calves that I could have sold as a result of owning that cow. And there are about 100 and some odd people working in this Digital Crimes Unit, but a small percentage of them work in Seattle. Many of them are in places like Russia and China and, you know, all throughout Europe and Asia. And what we do is when you mess with our computers within those, we have these things called use rights within our operating system. And when you abuse those use rights, we invoke this law of chattel. And you probably know that malware is made up of two parts. One is a brain that lives someplace on the internet, and the other part is these zombie botnet armies that live on your computers, and the brains control the malware. What happens when we sever this tie legally using this law of chattel, we go in as we sever the tie between the brain and the zombie botnet army, and we move the brain into our data centers, into Azure, and now all the malware reports to us, and we take a period of time to shut it down. So what you'll notice here is that, you know, we've been up and running since about 2010. We've shut down almost 100 different types of malware at this point. And this is a quick malware 101. The first type of malware is worms. They just want to find new places to infest. First is something like spam. If you want to know what spam is, you know, we can have a sidebar conversation. I can probably do this after this call and explain to you how spam works. Most people do. Advertising fraud is another interesting one where people actually hold you ransom and they put the foot on the scale of your advertising to drive the cost up. And then finally are things like the Citadel botnet, which is the orange or yellow one here. What Citadel would do is it would wake up periodically when you would log into your financial institution, and it would keystroke log your user ID and password. And then what they would do is they would issue microtransactions of 5 cents, 7 cents, hundreds of thousands of times a day. And interestingly enough, it took us about 18 months to shut this one down. And you know, we used a variety of tactics, but it, you know, the banks reported that this it cost them about $500 million. And so what I'm showing you here is a map of the United States. This is actually using something called PowerMap, which is built into Excel. And at the height of the Citadel malware, it had infected 5 million computers. What I'm going to do is just kind of, I'm going to tap on this and play this for you. And what you're going to notice is that wherever there were people who did online banking, there was an infestation of this malware. So here in the United States, lots of people all throughout the East and on the coast. If you go through Europe, there's a ton of people all the way through Europe. But this is a little bit of a geography lesson. People do banking everywhere in Europe. And yet, what we saw when we visualized this malware is that there's a very strong stop to this data. It literally stops at the border of Russia. And when we saw this, we were like, wait, malware doesn't understand borders. And so we took this malware. We also don't have the source code for this malware either. So what we did is we took the malware, we threw it into our labs with a few thousand virtual machines, and we tried to see what it was doing. And it turns out that this malware only infested machines that did not have the Russian and Cyrillic languages loaded on them. So if you had the Russian languages loaded on your computer, the malware, Citadel, didn't infect you. You'll also notice that Moscow is lit up like a Christmas tree, and that's because those are expatriates, people who they're on vacation, you know, English speakers, French speakers, German speakers who are in Moscow. So we take this data to the Russian foreign dignitaries along with the FBI, and we tell them, this looks like cyber warfare, prove us wrong. And they say, we have nothing to do with this. And so we say, well, fine, then help us shut it down. And they do. And it turns out that there's two servers responsible for this malware, and one is in Pennsylvania and the other one is in New Jersey. So along with the FBI, we go into those data centers, we pick them up, and we move them out of their data centers and into ours. And they go to interview these people. And they say, what are you doing? And they say, well, why are you doing what you're doing? And they say, well, if we infected our own country, we knew that our local law enforcement would come and get us. But when we go after Germany and France and the United States, none of you guys care. And so they were banking on the fact that they didn't think that we would ever come get them or find the data or share it with the Russian foreign dignitaries, which we do. And I know what you're thinking. You know, so I'm going to call that out in a second, by the way. So, by the way, you know, the other interesting thing about this is now we're getting these from about 85 to 90 million devices, a unique IP address is talking to us every day, and we get about 750 to 800,000 million pings daily. But it used to be that machines like our PCs and servers were the devices that they went after. But now what we're noticing is that these hackers are going after whatever they can get their hands on. And there's a really great site on the internet called Red Balloon Security. And if you ever want to be freaked out for a while, go and check this out. And on YouTube, there's a video, which I actually publish. I'll show it to you here in a second. And during a live demonstration in Singapore, what this guy does is he says, I want to come work for your company. And he sends you his resume. And embedded in that resume is PostScript language that takes the firmware of your printer and replaces it with his firmware. And then during this demonstration, he jumps from his PC to that printer to the switch to the router, and he turns off the conference room phone. And that should freak you out. And what we're starting to see is that largely PCs and servers are still a great attack vector, but in the new Internet of Things, you know, these projectors, your refrigerator, different devices in your house and in your environment are the ones that are being impacted. By the way, that guy calls HP and says, I think I found a vulnerability in your printer. And they're like, this was in 2011. And the people who initially responded were like, nobody goes after printers. And he's like, well, I would. And so the next month, by the way, 57 firmware printer updates came out. And, you know, so it puts us all on our back foot. We have to be a little bit, we have to think about the world differently as it relates to cybersecurity. And yet, this is probably what you're thinking. Why do I care? And so the very first thing that I want you guys to know is that you know, oop, my slides are progressing without my knowledge here, is that if you guys have a few hundred servers on the internet, you might get, my slides are still progressing, you might get a few hundred points of data. Microsoft added 1 million cores to Azure in the month of July. And this is the first product where you see that is an Azure Active Directory Premium. And so what you're seeing here is people who are logging in, if you're logging in constantly from California over and over and over, and then suddenly you're in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, we'll flag that in Azure Active Directory. If you log in with a device with no IP address, that looks weird to us, we'll show it to you in Azure Active Directory. And Microsoft also plays a role in this place of the internet called the dark web, which is where identities and credentials and credit cards are bought and sold. And if we see one of your identities being bought or sold, we'll actually show it to you here in Azure Active Directory. And with a few clicks, what you're seeing here is somebody named Shirley, we found that her identity has been leaked. And with a few clicks, we can search for Shirley in Azure Active Directory. We can enable multi-factor authentication, and it's 3 clicks, to be honest with you. We can enable multi-factor authentication. And now the next time that Shirley logs into her any service that's based on Azure Active Directory, including 2,500 federated partnerships with all kinds of stuff, her phone's gonna ring. And that's what you're seeing here on the screen. She's logging into Office 365 and her phone rings. Now we're able to validate that Shirley actually is who she says she is. The next place that you'll see this pop up is in this thing called the Azure Operational Insight Dashboard. And what you'll notice here is that it's kind of a single pane of glass in the sky or in the cloud. And if you have investments in places like Amazon or Hyper-V or VMware, you can install an agent. We'll aggregate all of that data up into our cloud. And now we'll show you things like, are you at capacity? Have your servers drifted off of a baseline? Do they have updates in terms of malware and patches and hotfixes? But one of the things that you'll see here in the upper right-hand corner is we'll roll up all of that security data right to you in one little widget that gives you a consolidated view. And then it gives you the ability to drill down and find out what's really going on. Another thing that's a little more forward-looking is this thing called the Azure Security Center. And think of this as almost like the precursor to a SIM, a security information management tool in the cloud. And so right here, what you're seeing in the center of this is things like, I'll try and zoom in here for you, things like brute force attacks, SQL injections, people logging in from devices without an IP address. And you notice that it's not just coming from Microsoft. We're aggregating things from like Trend Micro or Barracuda. And this provides you kind of like with one view in the cloud of all of your investments. And as our machine learning learns new tactics being done by hackers, it's going to show up here automatically. So that's something that's a little bit more forward looking. You know, in terms of Microsoft services, I want to put 3 tools in your tool belt that'll help you. You know, hopefully you'll never get breached. You know, nobody wants to. I'm not trying to necessarily sell you services. What I want you to do is just be aware of what they have to offer. And I'm going to kind of walk through them as good, better, best, or easiest to hardest, cheapest to probably more expensive. And the first one is this thing called a security risk assessment. And the way I want you to think of this is that if you have Microsoft Premier support, you use those hours to consume this service. And what they'll do is they'll come into your environment, they'll conduct an audit. And what you get back is a report card that says, if we were you, here are some of the things that we would change. This next one, this threat detection service, is a longer duration because it has the word service at the end of it. It's a little longer in duration. What happens here is that people actually come on site and they do a detailed analysis of what you own and what you have. And that might not just be Microsoft stuff. It might be other investments you have in other operating systems or other solutions. And now what they do is they take that data, that knowledge of you, and we merge it with the things coming out of this digital crimes unit. And what you get back is a report with analyst comments that say, you have this going on in your data center, and we're seeing this going on out in the internet, and here's what we would change if we were you to address that current vulnerability. And then finally, if you ever get breached, and nobody wants to get breached, and I hope you never do, if you ever get breached, typically, you might call a company like FireEye or Mandiant or one of these other companies that would drop in out of the sky and they conduct something called an incident response. Those are really painful. I sat on a panel with some folks from the Secret Service and the FBI recently, and they said, you know, we get this telemetry, we know what malicious traffic looks like, and we estimate that somewhere around 50 to 60% of routers are now spewing some form of malicious activity. And so they're starting to get into the business of telling companies when they see it. You know, when that kind of thing happens, and I'm not a FUD guy, a fear guy, so I don't want you to think that I'm trying to spray fear against you. But this PADS engagement, this persistent adversary detection service engagement, is kind of like when they do a mock exercise. And so, you know, sometimes they'll do mock exercises for natural disasters or terrorist events, and they'll say to the police and the fire department and others, they'll say, respond as though it actually had happened. That's what this PADS engagement is. And so what people will do in these PADS engagements is somebody like this guy named Jeremy from our incident response team, who's known as in the hacker community as the Beard, shows up, and they will reverse engineer out what a hacker did to get in. Companies like FireEye and Mandiant, they use these folks like Jeremy to do that stuff. And what we're seeing is not necessarily as high as what the FBI is seeing. In about 40% of our engagements, we're actually finding out that customers who are doing this mock exercise with PADS are actually finding out they're actually already infiltrated. And so that changes Microsoft's mindset. It messes with us, and it changes the way we think about everything going here forward. And I'll tell you how that messes with us in a little while. So physically, I'm going to kind of walk through some of these things, almost like the OSI model, like starting with physical and then stepping up through application and then above the application into the service layers. Physically, Microsoft has 28 regions, of which 22 are online today. There are six that are coming online shortly, and two of them are in Canada to address Canada's concerns over the Patriot Act. There's also two coming in Germany, which has some of the tightest privacy and compliance laws in the world. And then finally, two in the UK. And you'll notice on the lower right-hand corner here, it says that when we operate those data centers in Germany, we actually operate them through Deutsche Telekom. And there's a bunch of RBAC, role-based access control solutions that we put in place. And Microsoft never has any standing level permissions into that data. When we operate in China, we assume that because we have to be behind the Great Firewall of China, that they're doing their best to get into that data. But we don't change a process that we do in China relative to what we do in Chicago. We use the same operational methods and the same security and the same rigor. You know, these regions matter because of data, things like data sovereignty. We just can't have you have, if you're a US country, a company with a presence in the UK, you care about data sovereignty. If you're a company with people in France or Germany, you care about data sovereignty. You'll also notice, we say hundreds of data centers. Each of these regions can consist of one or more data centers, along with peering relationships that we have to deliver things like content distribution networks to solve speed of light issues. Our network capacity is doubling every 18 months. And you'll notice it says 2.5 times the size of Amazon and 7 times the size of Google. And that's once again because of those data sovereignty issues. That's why those regions matter. And we have 2.5 times the size of regions of Amazon and 7 times the size of Google. We also have the largest virtual machines on the planet with 32 gig and 448 gig of RAM, just massive stuff in the cloud. If you ever get a tour of any of our data centers, which, you know, if you're one of our enterprise customers, we love that. We'd love you to get a tour. If you're standing in a regular data center, this is customer insult time. You know, if you're standing in a regular data center, you probably know that cold air is pushed up off of the floor and hot air is sucked off of the ceiling. If you're not doing something called hot aisle containment, where you have separation between the cold and the hot sides, we refer to that as a generation one facility. As soon as you separate the hot aisle and the cold aisle, either through your rear door heat exchangers or physical walls that separate the cold and the hot sides, that would be referred to as a generation two facility by the industry. Generation 3 takes that idea of hot aisle containment, and we move it into a shipping container, and that's what's in the Northlake data center here in Chicago. So this is a little video that shows you what it looks like. There actually is, we do have some raised floor areas, but most of it is 57 parking spaces. Each of those, and we bring in containers that have 2,500 servers at a time, and we drop them at the edge of the facility. We pick them up with air skates, and we park them. And in a little under 6 hours, we go from nothing to production servers running data, running actual production data. This data center is actually really close to the, it's the first pole off of one of the power yards here in Chicago. And the largest suburb of Chicago is one called Naperville, which has 123,000 people in it. This data center consumes as much power as Naperville. It's only half populated. And so, you know, 440,000 servers in a little over 700,000 square feet. And we fail about 400 disks a week in this facility. This facility is meant, the whole Azure fabric and everything that supports it is meant to fail. The objects recognize failure and readjust on the fly. It's magical stuff. If you ever get a chance, we would love you to go see this. This is generation three. Generation four actually takes this idea, and Dublin is a generation four facility. We take the air right off of the ocean. We take out the salinity, and we take out the humidity, and we use natural air. Every time we do one of those things, we expect something to go down. It's called power utilization effectiveness. And if we could make that equal to one, that would be a perfectly efficient data center. And you know, if we had more time, I could go into how PUE works, but do a little bit of research into power utilization effectiveness. If you ever get a tour of our data centers also, you'll notice that we do a bunch of things. And on this slide here, I've got some of the things that we do. So for example, you know, there's all these special fencing that has cables that will absorb trucks and tanks and things like that. They stretch out and absorb the impact. It says we have days of backup power, but you know, the diesel can be fed directly into the back of this data, you know, into the back of this data center outside the fence, and we can literally keep it running forever. You'll notice that it says seismic bracing. We seismically brace the Chicago data center, even though it does, we don't have earthquakes here in the Midwest, at least not yet. And then multi-factor authentication for everything. There's never a time when somebody can walk through the facility and actually get access just by passing one form of authentication. We always challenge people multiple times. There are physical keys, by the way, and if we ever lose one or if it gets taken home, we have to rekey the whole facility within 24 hours. I mean, crazy stuff. It's awesome rigor that we put into these data centers. This is a handful of the things, actually this is probably all of them, I think, of the compliance attestations that we make in our data centers. And some of these are non-negotiables. So you'll notice this top row of the industry ones. You can't turn off things like SOC 1 or SOC 2 or ISO 27001. Those are not negotiable. But if you said to us that you needed to support, for example, HIPAA, that's not a consulting engagement. You go to a web page, you check a box, you enable the service, you sign a digital form, and the functionality gets added. And so if you have multiples of these, right, you just check a few boxes, you enable them, they get changed in your tenant with some notification. You know, you'd schedule it and let people know that it was coming. So if you need to adopt something in the future, like whatever the EU safe harbor clauses end up becoming, because they just got blown up, you would be able to enable those quickly, or if you guys move into different countries. There's also one in here that we recently added, and it's called ISO 27018. And if you love sleepy time reading material, this one is great. I've pulled out the key sentence that you should care about, and it's basically that you own your data. Microsoft does not, we're not entitled to own your data. When you put your stuff in your cloud, you own it. And we give you the controls to put, you know, to mandate how that data is kind of controlled and traverses our service. This also tells us if you ship us a hard drive to pre-populate a database, for example, in Azure, how that hard drive has to be shipped, how we have to control it, how we might have to destroy it or ship it back to you. All of those things are a part of ISO 27018. We were the first cloud vendor to add this to our service. We're very proud of that, obviously, because we take this really seriously. This isn't like an afterthought for us. And you know, there's a website, actually, this used to be two websites called the Trust Centers, but recently we merged them. And if you want to know what Microsoft is are doing in your tenant for Azure or Office 365 around security, privacy, or compliance, if it's in this website, we do it. If it's not in this website, we shouldn't be doing it. There shouldn't be any delta. Microsoft is working to be the most transparent company on the planet, and in order to do that, we need you to be able to read exactly how we manage your Azure and Office 365 tenants. And so those websites obviously have a ton of data in them. But anything related to security, privacy, or compliance. You know, in Office 365, there's this thing called the Service Trust Portal. So often when, you know, you have hybrid solutions or you're using our cloud, your internal auditors need to be able to attest that you're compliant for something like PCI or HIPAA, or for example. And so if you need to attest that, on the Office 365 site today, there is a place where you can just pull those attestations down. You don't have to call us. You don't have to schedule anything. You can just grab it. And so if you don't believe that we're doing encryption in Office 365, I'll zoom in again. Oh, it keeps doing this where it goes forward on me. If you don't believe that we're doing encryption in Office 365, you can pull down the document. We tell you and attest to exactly how we do it. This is actually, that one in particular is a long Word document with a bunch of links, and so it shows you how we do data at rest, data in motion, backups, all those things, and how it's encrypted. It's actually really cool. There's for Azure, there's a separate process today. I'll just put on my speculation hat here for a second and say that I can assume that at some point we would merge these two things so it's not one tool for Azure and one for Office 365, just like the trust portals. They used to be two different sites. Now that we've merged them, we try and not make it hard for you, especially as people put more and more things in our public cloud. Next is, if you ever get a tour of the data center here in Chicago, there's two people who conduct those tours. One is a guy named Andrew, and the other one is a person named Dan. Those two people work for a group inside of Microsoft that used to be called Global Foundation Services. We just renamed it, and I can never remember the acronym. But those folks who work for GFS, Global Foundation Services, they can access from the fence of the facility. They can touch all the way from the fence up to, like, perhaps a cage or a container where stuff is being stored, but they don't have any privileges to go in containers or go into cages to touch any of that stuff. Consequently, there's a separate team inside of Microsoft called the Azure and Office 365 engineering teams. They should never be getting a tour of our data centers. And they don't, they shouldn't. Consequently, the person who works for GFS should never have any logical access to the service in Azure or Office 365. It's that complete separation of physical versus logical. And you'll notice there's some slight overlap at the host where one is the physical server itself and the other one is the virtual machine that rides on top of it. And there's some handoff between those two teams. And if you ever have to call, this will kind of give you an example of how a support call works at Microsoft. If you ever, let's just say that you're in Azure. This is an Azure example. It could easily be an Office 365 example with one addition, which I'll show you in a second. If you ever make a call, what happens, and you say that, one of my Azure virtual machines is messed up. It's not acting right. I need you to reset it for whatever reason. It's just an example. You would call us. Somebody would open up a ticket with Premier. You would call directly into Azure support. What would happen is that would get routed to a queue for Azure or Office 365, for example, and then it would be assigned to a manager, and that manager would then assign it to a queue of individuals. Those people would be checked to see if they've done all their training, if they're on any no-fly list, government watch list, debarred list, literally, if they've done all the things that they're supposed to do for their role, and if they haven't, they don't get it. But if they have done all those things and they've passed all those check marks, what happens is they're issued a one-time user ID and a password for a period of minutes to run a script, not console access. We've got 440,000 servers in that data center outside of Chicago, and console just doesn't scale. We only have a handful of people who are even technical who understand what a server is there. Most of the people who work there are managing water and network and power and things like that, not servers. So they're issued a one-time user ID and a password to run a script for a period of minutes. What you get back as the customer is the success or failure of that script, what time it started, who kicked it off, what manager it went through, what router it went through to get there, and originally who made the call on your side to originate that ticket. You get that complete attestation back. That's really amazing. By the way, this thing that's in that pink box there is called just-in-time provisioning and just-enough administration. I'm going to rewind the clock on you back to that thing I referenced called the persistent adversary detection service, where they conduct that mock audit and we found that customers have been breached about 40% of the time. The outcome of one of those engagements could be something like a Red Forest design. And a Red Forest design is where when a hacker's busted your enterprise admin or domain admin accounts, the nasty truth is that you may not ever be completely sure if you've ever gotten them out. And so sometimes what people have to do is this thing called a red forest design. It's painful. What we do, well, not we, what consultants do, is they take your existing domain and we build a new one with all these security hardenings around it, multi-factor authentication, all this other stuff to harden it. And then what we do is we take the SID history of your existing domain and we burn it to the ground and we migrate the SID history. And now when the malware wakes up in weeks or months later or years later even, it doesn't have a context to run in. That sounds painful. It is. In this just-in-time provisioning, what's left behind in a directory is just a handful of service accounts. Maybe, you know, but we try and use it to remove all the domain admin and enterprise admin credentials. And what these service accounts are hardened with things like multi-factor, or they can only talk through dedicated management workstations that are once again hardened and isolated through policies. The goal of this just-in-time provisioning would be to remove your domain admins and enterprise admins. This will be a feature that's going to be built into Server 2016. So I would argue that you have two choices. One is to look into something like a Red Forest design now, or to start evaluating Server 2016 when it ships later on this year. Really cool stuff. So in Office 365, there's this added feature called Lockbox. By the way, I don't like it when we use acronyms and customer-facing decks, so it's available now in Exchange Online. You see that on the top. Available by the end of 2015 for EXO, Exchange Online. And hopefully by March, it's on our roadmap to be available for SharePoint Online by March. The added piece of thing that we added in the Lockbox scenario is the customer still makes the call. It still gets routed through a Microsoft engineer. And we go and grab, you know, a key through the lockbox system, which is issued by the manager. But now what happens is you get a call as the customer, or a web, or a link in an email or through an application that's that might go back to somebody like your auditor or your chief security officer or somebody with a level of control that's above and beyond just a person who can open up a ticket. And they have to allow that transaction to take place. And once they do, then the engineer is issued the key and they can run that script and check the outcome. So this lockbox is a great piece of an added attestation or kind of an audit. It gives you a higher level of assurance that somebody's not just opening up tickets like some maligned employee who decides the day they get fired to kill all your services or reboot all your servers or do something that you don't want them to do, for example. Cool. You know, I'm going to go through these things quickly. You know, in our cloud, first thing I'm going to start with is data segregation. And in our cloud, you know, you might be running on the same servers physically that Microsoft is running on. It's a shared service. And so we have to be able to attest that we, as Microsoft, can't see your data and vice versa. And so we do that. We have, as a part of that trust portal, there's a document that you can pull down that shows you how we do tenant isolation. And that happens at the network, it happens at storage, it happens at the virtual machine, it happens in the global address list, it's having in the OU structure of Azure Active Directory. All those things are outlined in that document. The next one is encryption of data at rest, or in transit, I should say. And data in transit is always encrypted. So if it's client to our cloud, server to server, site to server, site to site, you know, any combination that you express route, MPLS, it doesn't matter what acronym you throw at me, data is always encrypted in transit. There's one place where you can allow it to be unencrypted, and that's through the RESTful APIs, but that would be your choice, not ours. By default, the box is checked. And then finally, data encryption at rest. And so I'm going to use this opportunity here to kind of whiteboard out some things for you. And I'm doing this because I want you to understand not only how we do things like data encryption at rest, but also how we handle things like storage and cryptography to a degree. So this is a little bit of there's multiple reasons why I'm demonstrating this to you or talking about it. The first thing I want you to know is that in Office, and the example, by the way, that I'm giving you is how we actually handle advanced encryption in SharePoint. But it's got like lots of reasons why I'm showing it to you. First of all is that Azure is something called an appended file system, which means that if you upload a file to Azure, by default, we shred that file. Those shreds get put in multiple places. And so, for example, in a Word document, and by the way, Office 365 rides on top of the Azure as a backbone. So when you upload a Word document, we break it into three parts: part A, part B, and part C. A, B, and C. Pardon my writing. Now, if you append part B of that document, what we do is, rather than just changing part B, we break that out into three pieces: part D, part E, and part F. And now when a user goes back and requests that file from Office 365, we pull all those appended parts back and we give you the latest versions. This is what allows us to maintain versioning. It's what allows us to kind of maintain a few different areas of security for us. But it's kind of an important backbone component of Azure and Office 365. So I'm going to erase this really quickly. If you upload a document to SharePoint, now I'm going to start just kind of making the SharePoint specific. It's got to be at least 64K, but for the sake of an argument, let's just make it 1 megabyte. What we do with those three parts is we put them on three different storage areas. Think of them within a site collection, for example, within three different storage areas. And what we do is we encrypt those three different pieces with three different keys. Those three different keys are stored in three different lock boxes. So in the Northlake or Chicago data center, think of this as one shipping container, for example. Those keys are all AES 256, AES 256-bit encrypted, and the keys are rotated once a day. So nasty long keys rotated once a day. The interesting thing about this is that, the way we do storage in Azure and Office 365 is there's something called an erasure encoding. And I'm not going to go into detail on that, but basically, our storage works pretty much at the physical layer on the concept of JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And if you're familiar with RAID, there were two parts of RAID. There's the striping component and the parity component. We'll be opportunistic about how we stripe data to achieve I/O per second qualifications, IOPS, and we might move you to a different tier of storage if we need more of those IOPS. But what we do in Azure and Office 365, or in Azure as a backplane, is that we tend to use JBOD with this erasure coding stuff. What that means is that if you lost part A here, let's just say that this disk died, if you know anything about JBOD, what you would be like is, well, Paul, dummy, you just lost a 30-year file. Now I can't put it back together. I'm kind of stuck. So what we do to compensate for the idea of RAID, or parity, I should say, is we make two additional copies of that data. And what you're probably thinking is, man, that seems wasteful. Now I've taken a 1 meg file and I've essentially made 3 megabytes out of it. But you'll also notice that if you ever get a tour of our data centers, while we love companies like EMC and NetApp and others, Hitachi and things like that, we're not beholden to any of their storage strategies, which means that we can move things around between storage using this underlying component of Windows Server called storage spaces, and I can also move it between tiers of storage and types of classes and storage performance levels that I want. But this is what allows us to charge something like 2 to 3 cents per gigabyte per month for low-end storage for our customers. And as you move up through different tiers of storage, that price goes up, but it's still far cheaper than if you could ever do it on your own data center. By the way, if you ever do something in Azure, by default, there's no disaster recovery. So for example, if you're just using to do build tests for dev, like dev automation tests, where you're seeing if the functionality is working, like with Team Foundation Suite, for example, you wouldn't want DR as a part of that. So you'd have to check a box. If you do, what we do is we do it all over again in the new data center wherever we make your DR. By the way, this also doesn't stop us from doing things like backups, where the process in some ways starts all over again. When you do this in Office 365, for example, here in Chicago, what we do by default is we put you in San Antonio, for example, as the DR site in Office 365. But in Azure, you have to actually say, I want DR, because otherwise you'd be paying for something that you might not be using. Cool. But the idea here is that cryptography matters, and there's never a time when data is sitting still at a disk, either through BitLocker or through this thing which used to be called Fort Knox. Or if you're doing rights protection inside of a file, you might have 3 or 4 levels of encryption going on inside of a file system, which there's never a time when data is sitting still. This is a slide that if most companies want to take one back to your executives, this is the one that most people want to take back, and it's that you have control over the location of your data. You have control over who has access. You have control over the keys. In case of Azure, you can bring your own key, and soon in Office 365. And then finally over how data is deleted. So if you have a rule that says our data needs to be deleted after 7 years, we'll attest that the primary copies, the secondary copies, the tertiary copies, the backups, the search indexes are all deleted. And if disks die like they do 400 times a week here in Chicago, we also attest that those disks are destroyed. They're actually shredded in the data centers in which they live. It's a pretty cool process to watch, by the way. I mentioned that, you know, when somebody sends you that resume and it's got that PostScript language that replaces your firmware, or that the fact that 40% of our customers have been breached and they don't know it, that messes with us. So at Microsoft, we assume that we've been breached 360 days a year, 24 hours a day, meaning that there's full-time teams called the Blue Team that its job it is to be paranoid as all get out. Their job is to look for these incidents and these hackers all day long. They know that in part because there's a red team whose full-time job it is to attack us. We attack our own production data. Those servers are the same physical servers that your stuff might be flying, that might be riding on, but we attack our own data. There are very few rules of engagement there. One of them is that we don't allow distributed denial of service attacks, for example, against our own infrastructure. But most of the other rules of engagement kind of all holds, you know, are kind of removed. If you don't believe that we're doing all the right things in our cloud, you can actually schedule your own tests with us. We just ask that you actually call us. There's a website called that you can go to schedule them, to put that in place, because otherwise that might be a self-inflicted denial of service. Now I'm moving above the stack here, and the first thing is in Office 365, there's this piece of functionality called Advanced Threat Protection. You know, in here, there were things that we've always done, and I'm going to circle them here. We always did this. So when you would send us a file, we would check it with three different antivirus engines for malware and malicious sites, whitelist, blacklist, and we still do that. But now with this thing called Advanced Threat Protection, what happens is we break any attachment or a link that's sent off. And if it's a link, we rewrite it. And what we do with the links is we check them for machine learning to see if to look at your intent and see if the intent matches what you're getting. So if somebody sent me a video of kittens on YouTube and they replaced the O with a zero and I didn't notice, this would be like, I see what you did, sneaky person. You tried to get them to go to YouTube because you told them there was kittens there, but no, this is a site with some malicious stuff going on. It would block that. So all your links are rewritten. And if it's an attachment, we blow it up in the cloud and we look for things like elevated permissions, or if it's an executable, or is it making a registry change? And if it is, it goes into this bin where somebody else can go back and health check those later, if, for example, if it was a legitimate sending of somebody of something to you. But this ATP is a great solution, and it helps to solve a big aspect of spear phishing attacks and malicious attachments. There's also something that we added recently in our stack called Advanced Threat Analytics. And what this is, provides you with a Facebook feed in your own data center. One of the easiest ways to deploy it is if you take your domain controller, we port mirror it to this server, and now it's like this Facebook feed of ongoing traffic into your data center that would show you things. It takes a little while to understand what normal is, but after a while it starts to understand the abnormal traffic. So what you're seeing here on this screenshot is we got this person and they talk to a handful of servers normally, but now they're communicating with servers like they're enumerating the $$ share on a domain controller, and that's weird. Why is that happening? It will show it to you here. We'll notice things like pass the ticket or pass the hash. And through tools like Mimikatz and others that hackers are widely using now, this is some of the key things that they use in their arsenal, is things like pass the ticket and pass the hash and reconnaissance and brute force. And we'll pick those things up automatically. We'll also find you lateral movement. You know, people don't often talk workstation to workstation. Services may, like Skype, for example, or Skype for Business, but not users. And so if we see that lateral movement, we'll identify you that for you as well. So this Advanced Threat Analytics is an amazing tool. And this is not a SIM tool. This was something that might feed a security information management tool, for example, like a Splunk or a QRadar, or send it up to our cloud eventually at some point. Next, I'm going to talk to you about a handful of future directions and some of the things that we're seeing coming in the near future. The first one is this thing called Adalom. We bought these guys, and their claim to fame is that they could stand this up in 8 minutes. just for, you know, pragmatic sake, I'm going to triple it and I'm going to make it 24. But, you know, what they'll do is they will stand up these proxying solutions, and they have two versions of this. I'm not going to go into too much detail for time's sake. But what they'll show you is all of this stuff going across your wire, across your wires, and they'll identify all the shadow IT that's going on in your environment. They'll also tell you how much data is ingressed out of your company, how much has ingressed, how much is egressed, in and out. They'll show you where documents have gone. They'll show you how often documents are used. They'll show you services that aren't being used that you're paying for. They'll apply DLP on the fly. They'll also show you some of that anomalous detection. Somebody once asked me, so when will Adalon be available as a solution? I said, never. And they were like, what? And the reason why I say that is because probably what will happen is these Adalon components will be built into our stack, but we probably won't call it Adalon. We'll probably just move the component tree into our solutions, and you'll get them through a tool like EMS, for example. Licensing hasn't been formalized, so I might be speaking out of turn there. The other one that we recently purchased is a company called Secure Islands. And companies today, like most people, Microsoft included, I won't take us off the hook for this, have trouble classifying content. What Secure Islands does is they hook into things that we provide like Exchange and SharePoint, but they also will hook into third-party applications. And they have an SDK where you can hook them into anything that you've got. And they will start to classify things in real time. So if they see something flying across the wire that looks like 30% of a contract, they'll say, that looks like a contract according to your business rules. And they'll apply the metadata as well as the permissions right in line. That's a huge problem for most companies, because even for us today, we have to apply multiple passes against data. Once to search for it, once to look for the metadata, once to apply the metadata, and then once to do the DLP on top of it. Secure Islands does that with one workflow. Magical. So we're looking forward to having them in our stack. And then lastly here, I'm going to reattach my keyboard. Hopefully I won't drop my connection. This is an email to my mom. This is true. And this is how this conversation goes. My mom will often say things to me like, honey, you know, I forgot how to post pictures to Facebook, and here's my user ID and password along with the pictures. Could you please upload them for me? And I'm like, would you please stop sending me your email address and password and email? It's like the worst thing that people can do. So there's some really big things that Microsoft is working on. And if we have time at the end, I'm going to talk to you. And specifically, one is this thing called homomorphic cryptography. The other one is something called quantum computing. But I want you to imagine a day when we have quantum computers in place and using these things called qubits. If you put a private RSA keys in particular, particularly vulnerable to this, if you put an RSA key on the wire, we might have that thing decrypted in under 10 hours using something called Shor's algorithm. By the way, at the end of my deck, I'll provide you with links to this stuff so you can do more research. Using RSA keys in that example, all the secrets that were hidden behind those things are obliterated. And so Microsoft has two goals. First of all, we're working on quantum computing like mad to get there first, along with other companies. And second, so we can protect, but also we can help companies solve bigger problems. Quantum computing has a lot of opportunities as well. But the other big initiative for us is to get passwords off of the wire. And so I'm going to go back to my screen here, and you guys are going to see my screen. What I'm going to do is I'm going to lock my workstation. This is live. Okay, so the first thing I want to tell you about before I do that is there are two pieces of things built into Windows 10. One is called Windows Passport. And what happens is we'll store some of these new gestures onto the trusted platform module, the TPM chip of your computer. And hello. So we need new sensors to pick those things up. So things like infrared cameras and depth sensors and things like that, and regular webcams. And we merge all of that data to provide like a gesture. A gesture could also be your thumbprint. On the case of my phone, it's my iris. But when I do that, it actually does something a little bit different than a traditional password. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to lock my workstation. This happens really quickly, by the way. I hit Windows L, I lock it, and what you'll notice is it says looking for you, and it says, hello, Paul, swipe to dismiss. I swipe, and it logs me in. What you would see if you could crack open the wireless connection is actually that the public key traverses the wire, which is public. That's normal. And then the second thing that transitions it is something called a nonce, N-O-N-C-E. That nonce is a one-time negotiation between me and, in this case, Active Directory that says, okay, I trust you and you trust him, so if you trust him, I'll let him in. And so what's never going across the wire is this password, and it's a one-time nonce. So the next time I use facial recognition, by the way, I think I was wearing my glasses for that last one. I'll take them off for this one. And when I hit Windows L and I log in, now it says swipe to dismiss again. And so it does it with and without glasses. We know variations of you. If you grow a beard, that doesn't change it for us. These new sensors are what provide us with that capability. They're really important building blocks. But the goal, once again, is to take the password off of the wire. And quantum computing is probably 7 years out. It's far in the future. But we know how long it took people to get off of Windows XP. So I would argue that you need to start looking at ways to remove passwords off of the wire. And we're arguing that this is a really good way. With that, I have a few calls to action here, and some of them are things that I've talked to you guys about, things like Shor's algorithm, some of the quantum computing stuff, technical details on Hello. I provided you with some of the links. There's a guy at Microsoft named Tim Raines, and I've never met a better presenter all up on this topic. And so his blog is a great place to look where if you want to know what Microsoft is thinking about cybersecurity all up holistically. Tim is a great blog himself. The other thing that I want you to remind you of is that you guys have account teams likely. If you found this link, you probably are covered by Microsoft in some way. And I'd ask you that if you want to go into more details, please reach out to them. And if they need to find me to go into more detail, I certainly can do that. I'm happy to do it with you guys. But please reach out to your account executive and to do those things. And with that, actually, we've got about 10 minutes for questions and answers. And I wanted to take this time to open up the floor, and Mark is my man behind the curtain here. Mark's gonna, if there are any questions that you guys have, now is your time to kind of like stump the chump, if you will, and we'll kind of go wherever you want me to go.
Paul, I've got a question here. The question I have is, we talked a lot about what's available in Azure. What's available for customers that are mainly on-prem today? Do we have anything for security?
Yeah, so and thank you for asking that, actually. And so, you know, a lot of the things that I talked about in the digital crimes unit, they feed these products. So these investigations that we do and how we tear down malware and botnets, those are very important building blocks. And that ATA, that advanced threat analytics thing, is an on-prem thing. Some of the other things, like I mentioned in Server 2016 with removing, you know, taking all the domain admins and enterprise admins out, those are also important things for us. As it relates to some of the ways that we help customers in the future too, there are things that I didn't get a chance to talk to because it's, you know, I only have an hour. But built into the Enterprise Mobility Suite, which is a suite of products and capabilities that are very inexpensive. You know, usually one competitor, is the value proposition to buy the entire suite for us. They include things that provide us with this ability to do a combination of four things. Who are you? What are you? Where are you and how are you? So who are you? I'm Paul. I'm on an iPad. I'm at McDonald's. And the device is managed with mobile device management. Using that combination of who, what, where, and how, and in the cloud, something like Intune, but on-prem, something like Windows Server 2016, and a kind of a handoff of these hybrid scenarios, once again through Active Directory and Azure Active Directory, working in hybrid, gives you the ability to say, who are you, what are you, where are you, and how are you? And then using combinations of those things to say, well, it's Paul, he's on an iPad, he's at McDonald's, and he's enrolled in MDM, and he's trying to access this Linux server. Well, from McDonald's, I'm only going to give him read access, unless I can pass multi-factor authentication to him, get him to validate himself again with an iris scan or making his phone ring and typing a PIN. Those are just a handful of clicks. And now you can provide that same capability on-prem. So once again, for us, it's not an or conversation. There are some technologies that are lit up by our cloud, but we don't look at these things as ors. We look at them as ands and combinations thereof. So hybrid means something to Microsoft, and we're really the only cloud vendor that thinks of hybrid this way. Strong cloud, strong on-prem capabilities. Mark, anything else?
Paul, do you really think the cloud is as safe as on-premise systems?
Yeah, I was asked this question yesterday in a briefing that I conducted with a customer. They asked me that same question, which I'll re-read it again. Mark said, do you really believe that your cloud is as safe as what we can do on-prem? I'm not going to be that bold. You know, what I will say is that this is an arms race, and hackers, they go after everything equally, and for us, these investments with these hundreds of people doing red teaming and blue teaming is often a thing that customers in and of themselves can't afford to do. And the constant machine learning that we do in the cloud to understand the new attack vectors. You know, I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but when I showed you that map of the infection rates, it used to take us about 24 hours to rebuild that cube of data. We're rebuilding it now in Azure every 5 minutes. So we're literally seeing 0-minute exploits. And the sooner we can identify those things and mitigate them, the faster that it turns into, you know, some protection, form of protection. So I wouldn't argue that it's an either or. You may be very well versed at protecting certain aspects of your company, but hackers are getting brilliant. And I wouldn't say that anybody was thinking about the firmware on their printers when this hacker put that stuff out. The world changes constantly. So I would just say, I wouldn't say that, you know, I won't be so bold as to say our cloud is always better than your on-prem. I do, you know, in many ways I do believe that, but I wouldn't be that bold to say it's 100%. What I would say is that use the lessons that we learn to augment the great things that you do, because I feel like we're moving in a really strong direction, and the amount of telemetry that we gain at Microsoft is jaw-dropping. 3 billion authentications against Office 365 and Azure every single day. I mean, it's just huge kind of data that we see. Mark?
So that's great, Paul. You work for Microsoft, and I hear a lot of good things about Windows and Azure, but this customer is mentioning they have iPads and they have iOS devices and Android devices. You know, how do they protect that sort of environment?
Yeah, so, you know, if you asked me that question about 3 or 4 years ago, I probably would have been like, well, put it all in Windows, just migrate it. Microsoft is not that company anymore. You know, I just used an example where I said, you know, it's me, I'm at McDonald's, I'm on an iPad, it's enrolled with MDM. You're often seeing us put things out for other platforms first. So in the case of the modern version of Office, it shipped on the iPad before anything else. We went where the users were. We believe that we can put the best capabilities into our platform because we have the most amount of control there. But we're going to go where you are. And if you're on an iPhone or an Android device, Mac, Linux, whatever, we're going there. We're a software company. The big revelation of the last few years is that we're a software company. We certainly make these things like Surface Pro devices and Surface Books and phones. But we still think of ourselves as a software company, which we need to go where you are. So. You know, in other places, we don't have as much control like on an iPad. So in those cases, we argue for better controls to be put in place. And we do work with Apple and Google in the background, in those cases of those devices, to help solve bigger problems. And Samsung with the case of Fort Knox. I mean, we collaborate because we have to. None of these things are islands unto themselves anymore. Mark?
Well, I think we have time for one last question. If you were in a customer situation right now, do you really think that moving to Windows 10 is going to dramatically improve their security capability as opposed to Windows 7?
Yeah, so the question was, do I believe that Windows 10 is dramatically better than Windows 7? And that's one where I'm a pretty pragmatic guy. I firmly believe that Windows 10 is a jump, huge jump, over Windows 7. And if you go and look on side-by-side security comparisons of the things that you could do in Windows 7 that were just allowed, even with user access controls throttled up or throttled down, there were just things that we don't allow through the policies of Windows 10, or we've put really good controls in place to stop those things from happening. There are things like credential guard and device guard, and we health check between the BIOS and the operating system to see if any of those things have been messed with. And if they had, things stop working, you know, like the OS freezes. So if somebody rootkits you and messes with the firmware of your PC, Windows 10 just says, this has been tampered with. I no longer trust the underlying operating system. And you have to go back and fix it, right? Or you have to purposefully do something to break it. Those things are just built into Windows 10. Even in Internet Explorer and the new modern Edge browser, there's so many controls put in place that just stop things cold in their tracks. So yes, 100%. If you're not evaluating Windows 10, you need to get on the bandwagon. It's because it's magical. I want to finally just thank you guys. I mean, it's an hour out of your day, at the technology centers here, we treat your time as like really valuable resources. And so, A, I would encourage you, if you have a technology center that's near you, and talk to your account executive. But thank you so much for the time. We'd love to talk to you in person. Please reach out to your local account executive if you want to have more detailed conversations about this or anything else in the Microsoft wheelhouse. We love talking to you guys. Please come back. Thank you so much for your time. We really loved having you.